Welcome to this episode of On the Case, the LSE Law Society's podcast. I'm your host, Shania Kapoor. Without further ado, sit back and enjoy the show. The aim of this podcast is to provide listeners with a simplified yet structured understanding of the function of corporate groups at law firms, with a specific focus on the private equity sector for today's episode. I am thrilled to introduce our guest for today, Emmy Jones, a renowned partner at White & Case's private equity team. Emmy is not only part of the private equity team at White & Case's London office, but also co-heads the firm's fastest growing practice area. From structuring, negotiating, and executing highly complex cross-border transactions to advising growth investors and private equity houses on acquisition and management deals, Emmy offers a wealth of knowledge and experience with her profound understanding of the private equity sector. In this episode, we will explore her professional journey, gaining insights into Emmy's experiences, perspectives, and the trends that define the industry she has contributed to so significantly. By the end, we hope to demystify the buzzword private equity and spark your curiosity to delve deeper into this field. So hi, Emmy. Welcome to our podcast. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me. I'm looking forward to it.
Before we begin, I think it would be interesting to learn more about your journey into the legal sector, particularly your entry into commercial law, since a vast majority of our listeners are probably looking to go down the same career path as you. So was there a specific experience or encounter that sparked your curiosity to go down the commercial law route, or was it just pure trial and error?
It was largely trial and error. I mean, I would love to be able to tell you that there was some sort of road to Damascus moment where I realized this was what I loved. But I did history at university, absolutely loved history, and for a while weighed up whether I should stay in academia and try and do a PhD. But then I realized it's quite lonely and I like talking to people. I like being part of a team. And also I wanted to earn some money. I was fed up with being a student with no money. So I thought that I would try a job in the city. And there is quite a well-trodden path from history to law because there's a lot of overlapping skills in both. You're taking on a lot of information and trying to plot a path through it and come to a conclusion. So a lot of my friends and people I knew were going from history to law, so I thought I'd give it a go. I really enjoyed it. Actually, the topic I enjoyed the most was tax and trusts. So I started my training contract convinced that I was going to be a trusts lawyer, and then actually got to my training contract and realised that the seat I had enjoyed the most and found most rewarding was private equity. So from that moment, I was a committed private equity lawyer.
That's super interesting. And I think, like you said, I think the money is a very big motivation for us law students as well to go down that solicitor route. Can you maybe highlight some challenges that you may have encountered that made you the lawyer that you are today? I'm guessing that you must have had certain experiences that sort of shaped the solicitor that you became.
Yeah, I mean, just going back to the money point, there's obviously a lot of talk about how insane the salaries are in the city. And there is a bit of a bidding war between US firms. But you can't do this job only for the money because it is really challenging. It does take up a lot of your life. And if you only did it for the money, you would be so miserable. You've got to find some other value in it. And then the money is a nice part of that. But you've really got to find intellectual interest and enjoyment in all of this. But yeah, moving on to my experiences. I mean, I've been doing this 20 years now. It just seems like an insane period of time. But I think the city has changed a lot in 20 years. And I think it's changed. I hope it's changed for the better. Certainly when I was junior, there weren't really many female role models. You didn't really have that many women in PE, either on the client side or on the advisory side. And it was a challenge to be a private equity lawyer as I wanted to be one, rather than trying to emulate these men in their pinstripe suits who would thump their fists on the table and shout. And a lot of the commentary I got or the criticism I got from partners in my firm was they weren't sure whether I could get angry. They didn't know whether I could, basically, whether I could be them. And of course, I couldn't be them. There's no way that I would ever be a PE lawyer in a pinstripe suit, thumping my fist. So that was the challenge that I had to face, was to find my own way of doing this role and of finding success, but also finding enjoyment. Because I think if you are always trying to be someone else and to fit into a gap that doesn't really fit you, then that's quite miserable.
As you rightly mentioned, I think it's very important for anybody in this space, and especially women, to carve their own path and not to try and fit into a predefined mold. That delving deeper into your area of expertise, you have advised on some very intriguing deals. I read that you helped a tech-enabled sustainable energy business source a £200 million investment. You advised on the largest acquisition of a startup in Turkey, which subsequently became Turkey's first unicorn, and you worked on many more intricate cross-border transactions. Before we delve into the specifics of your work in the PE team, could you maybe provide a brief explanation of what private equity is and why it's such a critical component of the financial landscape?
Yeah, sure. PE, I do think it's one of the areas with the most jargon. So if you'll just give me a couple of minutes, I will try and cover off some of the jargon, because people talk very confidently about strip and sweet and rollover, and it must mean absolutely nothing unless you've got a background. So at its basic level, private equity is medium to long-term committed capital that's provided in return for an equity stake in a private company. So if I break down those points, key one is that it's medium to long term. So PE houses, the money will come in by way of a fund. So our pension funds and university pension funds and private endowments, they invest into private equity. It's one of the asset classes that they allocate funds to. And once they have committed money to the fund, it's then committed for a 10-year life, basically. The private equity house, which manages that fund, has basically got 5 years to raise it and 5 years to spend it, and then 5 years to get it back again. So it's a 10-year life of a fund. I mean, that is pretty long term in this environment. It's not like a hedge fund. You can't put your money in and 30 days later get it out again. If you're investing into PE, and therefore if PE is investing into a business, it is really for a relatively long term period. And then the other point that's important there is that it's committed capital. You can't exit a PE investment quickly. It's not like the public markets. You can't just buy and sell shares. PE houses, they invest into companies, and they are then involved in that journey until the company has got to a stage where it can be sold. And those sales will sometimes be to another PE house, where they're called secondary or even tertiary sales, depending on how many PE owners it's been through already. Or they might take it public, it might be an IPO, or they might sell to a corporate. And it's at that point of the exit that the PE house then has the money to return to its own investors, the LPs. The other key point is that this is capital provided alongside other stakeholders. And the typical structure for that is the private equity house taking a majority position, typically 75% or more. And then the remaining stake is held by management. And that is to incentivize the managers to grow the business, because at its best, private equity works where everyone is incentivized. Everyone will do well if the company does well. And it's in this manager stake that you get a lot of the jargon. So if a manager already owns shares in a business, say it's a founder who has set this business up, and they sell out to a PE house, but then stay involved, or maybe there's an existing private equity house in there and the management team is already in there and a new PE house comes and buys it out, the managers will typically reinvest some of their proceeds into the new structure. Because if you're the PE house coming in, you've got to be confident that the managers are truly committed to this and will see it to the next exit. And so them putting their own money in, you can't get a better commitment than that. So that money that the managers reinvest is called strip. And that tends to rank alongside the private equity's investment. And then the PE house incentivizes the management team by giving them sweet equity. It's sweet because they tend not to have to pay very much for it because it only pays out if the deal does very well, if the business does very well. And so you can get absolutely astronomical returns on the sweet equity. There was one deal I did where I think the managers from their suite got an 87 times money on money return. I mean, it can be really life changing. And that's the incentive part for the managers. And so you then have a situation where ideally the PE house and the managers are incentivized. They both want the same result, which is to grow the business and then sell it at the right time. And when people's interests are in alignment, that is where I think PE houses can offer something really beneficial to the financial landscape.
Thank you for that. I think a lot of students such as myself, we come across such heavy corporate and finance related jargon when reading the FT or the news articles. So learning about it and getting a clear picture about it, I think that helps a lot. You mentioned PE houses. So say, for example, you have a PE house or venture capital firm coming to you saying, you know, we want to invest in something. What does your daily work involve? How do you sort of make the deal happen?
What we would do if a client came to us and said that they wanted to buy a particular company, the first thing we have to do is due diligence. We have to understand the business, its contractual matrices, how it operates, how it employs its employees. We have to identify problems. Now, it's very easy as a very arrogant corporate lawyer or PE lawyer to think that you're at the absolute centre of a deal. But when I was more junior, I went on secondment to a PE house for a year. And what I realised there was that by the time a PE house approaches the lawyers to get involved and do the diligence, they've basically already decided that they want to do the deal. They have already done their commercial diligence. Financial diligence will be quite well progressed. So really, from a legal perspective, you're looking for problems. And one problem we did find once, there was a business that our client wanted to buy. And a key component of the client's investment thesis was that it would expand into the States. And we found during our diligence that the US side of the business wasn't actually owned by the company at all. It was all a franchise model. And those franchise arrangements would terminate on a change of control. In those circumstances, the client just then no longer wanted to buy because there's no way it would be able to achieve its investment thesis. So that is diligence that is absolutely key. You have to know things like that. Otherwise, when you approach diligence, you've really got to think, what is the purpose of my telling the client this? So we tend to split our diligence findings into a few buckets. One is, this is absolutely critical, like the deal shouldn't go ahead. And it's very rare that you come across issues like that. I mean, that time I've just described is the one time in my career. Otherwise, you look for things that are price points. Have you come across something that is a debt-like item that means that the price should be adjusted downwards? So, for example, has the company done M&A previously and there's still outstanding consideration? There's deferred consideration, so money that the business owes that really should be for the account of the vendor, not for your client purchaser. So the other bucket is debt-like items, price points. And then there's things that the business should try and sort out post-completion. It's not going to be enough to stop the business, but if you want this to be a best-in-class asset, and if you want to be able to exit easily in 3 to 5 years' time, you need to sort these out. So we think of these as 100-day plan points. It's, you know, your data protection policies aren't great. They should be improved. You've employed a whole load of people and described them as contractors, but actually they're probably employees. You should regularize that. And so what we're trying to produce in the diligence phase is something that's really useful for the client that they can take on. And it allows us really to understand the business, because to do the documents, you've got to understand the business, because there are all sorts of contractual protections that we should be putting in place for our clients if we've identified any issues. So then the second part of the deal is the actual M&A. It's buying this company. And so that's warranties, which are kind of promises that the vendor makes about the state of the business. And if any of those promises aren't correct, the purchaser can sue them for it. It's pretty rare that you get issues like that, that you have to sue under warranties. But It's certainly not a once in a career type situation. It happens relatively regularly. So you've got to make sure that the documents do what you want them to do. And then on PE, on the PE side, and what I makes it most interesting for me, that I find most challenging and intellectually stimulating, is the equity side. This is where you're putting together the relationship between the managers and the PE house, and it's all about how they fund the business. So their relationship as shareholders. And that for me is the most interesting bit. It's what differentiates private equity from just M&A, but it's also the part where you need the most emotional intelligence, really, because this is unlike an SPA, a share purchase agreement, that speaks at a point in time. When you're documenting the equity, you're documenting an ongoing relationship. People will not just put this document in a drawer. This will govern how they interact for the life of the investment. So it's quite often the most contested document, but it's also the one that is the most meaningful.
Thank you. I think, like you said, what separates PE is not just its finance and corporate angle, but also the fact that a large part of a successful transaction with PE clients is about the relationships that you build. Moving on to what you mentioned about PE clients, I'm guessing that given that you work at White & Case, a lot of your deal structures can be very complex, but at the same time can vary significantly. And you yourself have had a wide range of experience when it comes to advising private equity houses or corporate venture capital providers, all on their investments and acquisitions and management of equity deals. Could you possibly share an example of a particularly challenging or interesting private equity transaction that you've worked on and the lessons that you learned from it?
Yes. I mean, I've got so many interesting deals, and sometimes they're not interesting because of the asset particularly, but they're interesting because of the way we interacted with the client or the issues that got thrown up. So the deal that I did over the summer was interesting to me because it was a very, very challenging timetable. It was an auction process. So a lot of PE-backed businesses are then sold through an auction, because at least that way you're testing the market and you know that you're going to get the best price, or you hope you're going to get the best price because it's market tested. And it means that you can really up the competitive tension. So we put in our final bid. We were then given 4 days to get to signing. So 4 days over a weekend. I think we were told on Friday lunchtime and we had to sign it on Tuesday. So there's a huge amount of work that goes into that. And I mean, I'm describing this from a partner's perspective, but what I love and what I get a lot of enjoyment out of is how important the team is in PE. So in this particular deal, there was me, there was a senior associate, there was a junior associate, and there were two trainees. And every single person in that team, their role was absolutely crucial. I couldn't have done it without anyone. And what I enjoy is the fact that everyone has got their own job to do, but at the same time, there's a lot of interaction. People are really trying to understand the whole of the deal and how their role fits into it. And then, of course, those relationships are exactly mirrored at the client level. From the client team was a partner, a couple of VPs, and then a couple of analysts. And so that sort of slots really neatly into how we staff deals. And it means that as a more junior lawyer, very early on, you can start building relationships, which for me is one of the most important parts of the job. But you have these client relationships because when it's 3 a.m, you're on the phone to your counterpart at the PE house dealing with one of the jobs that is in your remit. Just as I would be talking to the partner, the trainees are talking to the analysts about the issues that they're coming across on the documents. So there's a lot of interaction, there's a lot of relationship building. And there's a lot of camaraderie. I mean, it was a really tough deal from a timing perspective. It was one of the most challenging timetables I've ever worked on, because having been given 4 days to get to signing, we then only had 10 days to get to closing, which was unbelievably challenging. But I think the team enjoyed it. I mean, at least they told me they enjoyed it. I do get that they maybe didn't feel they could tell me they hated every second of it. But they really seemed to enjoy it because it was interesting, it was challenging. There was a real feel that we were in this together, trying to achieve something for our client. And our client at the end was thrilled because we got the deal done and it was all structured as they wanted it to be structured. And the other thing that I enjoyed on this particular deal was it was super complicated on an equity side. We had a 100-page tax structure memo that we were trying to implement. So the money was coming into a Jersey structure, but then needed to be pushed down into US companies. And then some money lent in dollars, some lent into euros, and then pushed back up through the structure. I mean, it was really complicated. And we came across a particular tax-driven structure that I had never seen before. And to be able to say that, having done this for 20 years, to be able to say, wow, this is new, I haven't seen it before. How interesting. I mean, what other career can give you that you're constantly learning, there's constantly something new and interesting?
I think the key takeaways that I got from this experience that you had is firstly that the law firm that you work at, it encourages early on engagement and networking with clients, which, like you said, is such an important part. And very few law firms actually allow trainees and junior associates to get into the meat of the deal and actually work with clients on a one-on-one basis. So I think that's really interesting and exciting to hear about. And the second thing that I found really nice is the fact that you said the job is such and the firm that you're working in is such that you have to be this lifelong student where you're learning at the job, and especially in the legal profession where everything's changing. Very exciting, honestly, to see that your job is so intense, but at the same time, it's fun because you get to learn every day. And I think you've touched on something crucial when it comes to learning, given, you know, the inflation rates and obviously the cost of living crisis. I'm guessing that all boils down to affecting how private equity firms borrow and invest money. I was reading the other day, there was, I think, a conference in Paris where they were talking about how they're trying to move away from these mega buyouts and the traditional buyouts and focus more on private credit businesses that offer capital but also offer stable returns. So I think it's interesting to see how the current landscape, although it's obviously a much broader issue, how it affects these private equity firms on a more minor level. Just to delve deeper into that, how do you think that this current financial landscape has affected the work that you do when it comes to dealing with clients? How does it affect your role when helping clients make a shift from strategies that they would have followed had the market been all amazing and, you know, happy?
It's an interesting question. So I was at IPIM, the conference you mentioned, and we sponsor the Venture Summit. So I was there and I was listening to people give their views of what's going to be happening in the market. And it is a tough market, and particularly in venture. So venture and private equity, in the States, they tend to use those terms a bit more interchangeably, whereas in the UK, they're very different segments of the market. And so, yeah, it is really interesting. And there is a lot going on, or there are a lot of challenges, but every challenge is an opportunity for someone else. So a lot of money got pumped into startups, and now the valuations have totally collapsed. Venture funds aren't investing that much any longer. And so it's very hard for early stage companies to raise more money. But that means that there's likely to be a real consolidation across the market. And I think there will be a lot of M&A as probably corporates buy up these very early stage companies because they're potentially really valuable to a corporate. There's a lot of IP, there's a lot of innovation. And that's something that will be useful to other businesses. So I think we'll see less investment for early stage companies, but probably more M&A. And we will see people having to be more innovative in how they use their funds. I mean, you're already seeing a lot of advice to companies to bootstrap things as much as they possibly can. There's been a real shift from looking at growth at all costs to now looking to profitability. And that's a real change in mindset for these founders. So it is a challenging market, but there is always something going on because as a wider society, there are businesses that we need, particularly in early stage companies. A lot of what is being developed is to solve a problem. I mean, we've got energy transition, we've got a lot of clean tech that is coming through to solve a problem that exists. So I was listening to a woman who is a partner at a venture fund in the Middle East, And there they've got a very young demographic and very few people have access to power and people need food and clean water. And so what they are investing in is a lot of food tech, so plant proteins, vertical farming, things that will solve the problem that people are experiencing. And that's just really exciting. And that will continue. I mean, these people still need to be fed in a way that is as energy efficient as possible. And these problems won't go away. So people will still be trying to solve them. And it's then just up to us as lawyers and advisors to be working out the best way for that to happen. And maybe that is now through M&A rather than new investments.
Yeah, I think like you mentioned, there are challenges that are very obvious in the market. But like you said, the opportunities that it creates for PE firms to invest in causes that they believe in, especially sustainability-driven causes, I think that's really exciting time for the market. But speaking more about things that could possibly go wrong, now, given the current market scenario, I think that exit strategies have become more important than ever in private equity. Could you maybe discuss some of the common exit options and the factors that influence private equity firms?
Sure. Exit is absolutely vital to any PE deal. There's no point investing in something if you can't see how you can exit it. So there are some businesses, particularly ones where there's a very dominant founder, and so you have succession issues, and people look at that business and can't see how you could exit it, and therefore they don't invest. And so from the moment that you buy a business, you've got to have the exit in mind. And that's why all of the issues that we identify in our diligence needs to get addressed, because what you don't want are for those still to be issues when you're trying to sell this in 4 years' time. So from the moment that we have acted for a client buying a business, we are looking towards the exit and how you get that business exit ready. And then in terms of what the exit looks like, there's really three key options when you're looking at a larger, more mature business. You can IPO, but the IPO market is, notwithstanding the hugely successful Arm IPO recently, the IPO market has been closed for quite a long time. So that isn't really a credible route at the moment, but it might become more credible in the future. So there's IPO, there's a sale to another PE house, because different PE houses will focus on different size businesses and they will put different amounts of money at play. So you will get lower mid-market businesses, lower mid-market GPs who will write equity checks of say 50 to 100 million. And then as the business they've invested in grows, they would then be looking to sell that to say a mid-market house or upper mid-market house that writes equity checks of, I don't know, 300 million. And so that works up to a point, and secondary exits, so a PE house selling to another PE house, is very, very common. As a tertiary exits, where businesses have now been through three PE hands, the problem is as the business has gone through private equity ownership to private equity ownership, the synergies that you can take from the business and sort of the professionalization of the business has probably largely already happened. So you can come to it as a PE house thinking that you have a new strategy that can take the business up to the next level. But people are generally not super keen at taking a business that has already been through five PE owners, because there's maybe a limit to what you as the new owner can do to it and the returns you can get. And then you also sometimes have a problem that your LPs are probably also LPs in this other PE house. So they are both seller and buyer. And LPs sometimes don't really like that very much, because they feel that either they're not getting enough value on the sell side or they're overpaying on the buy side. There can be problems selling to PE, but it is a very common exit route. And then you can sell to a corporate. And sometimes it gets to a point where the corporate is really the most credible exit option. The difficulty for a PE house is that corporates sometimes can't move as quickly as PE houses. So if you're selling through an auction process, generally PE is successful in that process, because corporates can't really comply with a timetable that requires them to have completed in 10 days. It's just not really compatible with how they run their businesses.
Thank you for that. I think that was a very comprehensive layout. We can now delve specifically into White & Case and the work that they do within this sector. What is it actually like working at White & Case and working for White & Case, especially in a sector that is one of its key practice areas?
I love it. I think that US firms get a bit of a bad press in the market, but what I've realized moving to a US firm is that's basically all propaganda by English firms who are really having to compete now, or for the past 10 years have been having to compete in a way that they just didn't before US firms entered the market. And the nice thing about specifically White & Case, because this is my experience, but I'm sure that a lot of US firms are the same. We've basically all come from Magic Circle or Silver Circle firms, and everyone has left for a reason. There was some cultural fit that wasn't quite right, or they wanted to develop their practice in a particular area. So it feels as though everyone is bringing the best parts of their previous firm and trying to leave behind the parts that didn't work for them for whatever reason, and is building something new and exciting. You never say, oh, well, we do it this way because it's the way we've always done it, because actually we haven't always done it like this. Our PE team didn't exist 7 years ago. So things are always moving and always changing. And it feels to me a bit like we're competing in the Olympics under the refugee banner. Like everyone is here trying to build something, but build it together and trying to do things in a new way.
I think that's a perfect segue into my next question, which is to understand and debunk this myth about American firms and US firms not having much regard for a good work-life balance. I understand that you may not be able to speak for all US firms. However, how would you describe your experience at White & Case, and how would you sort of debunk this misconception?
I mean, it is important that everyone recognizes that PE in particular is a very demanding workspace. And when, like this deal we had over the summer, you have 4 days to sign and then another 10 days to complete, we will work either all night or 20 hours a day. It is intense. So I certainly don't want to imply that this is an easy environment, because it's not. And if people want to come into this sector, they've got to be very realistic about the demands that we made of them. But to me, this is PE. Like, this is how our sector works. And any transactional department, you have these peaks of work where you're coming up to completion, and then you're very quiet. And you've got to be comfortable working with these peaks and troughs. And some people aren't comfortable with that, and so don't like PE. They want a more steady state working environment. But for me, the demands aren't driven by the firm. They're driven by our clients. And these are clients that we compete for against all firms in the market. So English firms work for the same clients. And if you're going to work for that client, you have to deliver the service that they want. So I don't really understand this perception that US firms are worse than English firms, because we're all doing the same deals.
From what I understood, I think the main key takeaway from that is that it's about doing your best for the client. And like you said, clients may have varying needs. So thank you for that. I think that kind of clarified, you know, US firms working their lawyers more harder, whereas that's just not the case. I think now we can segue into our last section, which is on advising students in their applications. What advice would you give aspiring solicitors interested in pursuing a career at White & Case?
Yeah, there's a couple of things I would say on this. I mean, obviously, we'd be delighted if you wanted to apply to White & Case, but I think that you as students need to really understand your worth. You are super valuable to law firms. We all want the best and the brightest of you. And so I think you need to be very discerning about which firm would be right for you. And big international city firms aren't going to be right for everyone. And I think you need to have the confidence to think, do I want to apply to this firm? Can I see my life if I were to be a trainee and junior associate at this firm? Is this what I want my life to be? And I think it's for you to test us almost as much as it is for us to test you. You've got to know that this is a good fit. So I think come to us confidently in that it works for us as well. If this is genuinely a good fit between your skill set and what we need and the cultural environment we can offer, then that's fantastic. So I think be very clear about what you want and what will satisfy your requirements, and then look for firms accordingly and have the confidence to feel that you are assessing the firms as much as anything else. And then if you've decided that Whiting Case is somewhere that you want to apply, what we look for, what's absolutely crucial, particularly in PE, we want people who are intellectually curious, because as I mentioned earlier, you never stop learning on this job. And we want people who recognize that they don't know everything and there is a huge amount more to learn and they want to learn it. They're interested in why deals work like this and why we've said this and why the document has this in it, because it is a constant learning process. And if you're someone who likes to feel that you have entirely covered your subject area and know everything, it's probably not the right environment.
Delving a little bit more into that, you mentioned intellectual curiosity, and I think a lot of students would like to understand what that actually means. So obviously you mentioned being able to have that ability to learn constantly on the job. But other than that, would you say that academics plays a very crucial role for Whiting Case when it comes to selecting or screening out applicants? Or would you say that intellectual curiosity is more than just what's on paper? It's more about the student has to offer and what you get through from them at the job.
It's 100% the latter. So intellectual curiosity is far more than your degree results or your A-level results. The problem for law firms and consequently for students is that if you get thousands of applicants, how do you whittle them down? And so academics are important, not in themselves, but really as a way for us to sift through all of our applications. And maybe we are missing out because a student who's been predicted a third is nevertheless very intellectually curious and has a growth mindset. But unfortunately, that's not the way application processes can work, because we just don't have the resource to interview 3,000 people. So I definitely don't want to give the impression that your academics are of secondary importance. It's almost, there's a horrible term that is used a lot in management consultancy and in the States where people talk about hygiene factors. And what they mean is almost like the basic level. This is something you just have to get right. And you are expected to have sorted this out. And then you're almost tested on what comes above that. And so your academics are really hygiene factors. We expect you to do well at school and at university. And then on top of that, we want people who are always willing to learn, who appreciate that there is a lot more to learn and that they can develop further, and who want that.
And I think that would be a perfect way to end our podcast for today. Thank you, Emmy, for taking the time out to share your journey, your thoughts and your advice with us. Your expertise is honestly a real inspiration for law and non-law students and women trying to break into finance and corporate heavy sectors in the legal industry. Hopefully, we look forward to staying connected and perhaps having you back on our podcast in the future. So thank you for that.
That's absolutely my pleasure. It's been fantastic to talk to you.